Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the Greek government takes a bailout proposal to the voters.
It's very hard to know what exactly the motivations of the Greek government are at this time. It's a very confusing situation.
A spike in militant attacks in Egypt. The UN may officially mark the anniversary of a bloody European massacre. And the U.S. seeks the extradition of FIFA officials, coming up right here on The Voice of America. The Greek finance minister says he will resign his post if Greek voters approve Sunday's referendum on bailout terms demanded by European Union creditors. Greece is cut off from further European aid after failing on Tuesday to meet a midnight deadline for repaying $1.8 billion to the International Monetary Fund. That default marked the first time a developed country has failed to meet a payment deadline on an IMF loan. VOA's Jeffrey Young is following this story. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Well, Susan, I spoke with Alex Nickel. He's a senior fellow with the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. And I asked him what would be the constructive purpose of putting austerity measures or a bailout plan to a popular vote if this is a political cover.
It's very hard to know what exactly the motivations of the Greek government are at this time. It's a very confusing situation. Clearly, Mr. Tsipras is putting this package, which isn't really on the table anymore anyway, to voters in as a means to try to get additional leverage over other European governments, his creditors. Because if he's recommending that they reject, that voters reject the package, and he hopes that if they do say no, that he'll be able to go back to other governments and say, you see, I have democratic backing for easier terms for Greece.
But you see a situation here, he could hold a referendum and he could have a vote supporting his position. And then he could go back to the EU finance ministers and say, this is what the people of Greece
exactly
want. However, it's the EU finance ministers who hold the cash in their pockets at this point. And why would a referendum in Greece, whatever position that referendum may take, influence the finance ministers? They're the ones who have to decide, are we going to give more money to Greece or not? Do you see my position?
Yes, absolutely. It's true that right now we have a very antagonistic situation, that he has alienated the finance ministers and government leaders with whom he needs to do business if Greece is, you know, not to go belly up. And there's a very poor atmosphere right now. And I don't think that a no vote is really going to sway them towards offering better terms in this atmosphere. Nevertheless, I think we have to look at what the ultimate aims of both sides are. And I do think that both sides do genuinely want to keep Greece within the euro, the common currency of 19 European countries.
If Greece needs liquidity, and because of its difficulties right now, its inability to cover the IMF demands on June 30th, etc., if it is locked out of the conventional money markets, raising capital, raising liquidity, I want to bring up the government equivalent of junk bonds. If Greece were forced to issue so-called junk bonds, high-risk bonds, where do you think the pricing of that risk would be? What kind of interest rate would it take to buy into a precarious piece of paper? What would you think?
Well, as you say, right now, Greece is in effect locked out of capital markets. Its only potential source of funding is other governments right now, and the governments that Greece is dealing with aren't prepared to lend unless there's some promises made by Greece that are credible. I think it's impossible to tell what a real market rate for Greece might be right now if they were borrowing, because in the absence of a credible package of reforms by Greece, nobody would really be prepared to lend to them. So even on the junk bond market, if such a market were even to exist as a possibility for Greece, and I don't think politically that's really feasible right now. And I don't actually think that we're there yet. You know, I think although there is this highly antagonistic situation, I do think that there's willingness on both sides still to reach some form of accommodation. You know, in the end, it's still a negotiation, even in the most difficult of circumstances, about terms.
That was Alex Nickel, a senior fellow with the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Susan.
For the latest on how the Greek debt crisis is playing out on social media, Michael Lippin is here in the studio. Michael, what have you got?
He says, and how's it going? Yes, the debate over whether Greeks should vote yes or no in this Sunday's referendum is definitely heating up on Twitter. Hashtag Greferendum is the one many people are using to talk about that referendum, and the Topsy Analytics website shows that it's been tweeted 30,000 times within the last day. Now, one of the biggest advocates for a no vote is the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. And he hasn't been shy in using Twitter to say why people should vote no. His handle is at Yanis Varoufakis, and here is one of his latest tweets from today. Why a no vote in the referendum is a yes for a proud Greece in a decent Europe. And that tweet links to Varoufakis' blog, where he posted an audio clip of an interview that he did on Thursday with Australia's ABC Radio. Now, the interviewer asked Varoufakis how Greece could possibly mobilize a national referendum on such short notice, and Varoufakis responded by saying that Greece is on a war footing, which has focused the mind of the Greek bureaucracy, as he put it.
What are the chances that Greeks will follow the advice of the finance minister?
Well, you know, I've been looking at tweets about opinion polls on the referendum and what European betting companies are predicting, and it seems right now that the chances are greater for a yes vote than a no vote. VOA Greek journalist Zoe Ludaki tweeted a photo of one opinion poll highlighted by CNN today, and that poll showed that 59% of Greek respondents were planning to vote yes. Also, I saw this betting company Ladbrokes tweeted today that the chances of a yes vote in the referendum have risen to 74%, according to Ladbrokes odds. Susan?
Thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA has built a prototype of what it hopes to be the first aircraft to fly over the surface of Mars sometime in the 2020s. Shaped like a boomerang, the flying wing Prandtl M will be rather small, with a 61-centimeter wingspan and weighing only about 454 grams. The designers are planning to send this drone-like aircraft to Mars in a CubeSat, a miniaturized satellite. Once deployed in the Martian atmosphere, the aircraft then can glide down and land. NASA plans to use the Prandtl M to fly around Mars to look for possible landing sites for future manned missions to the Red Planet. The aircraft will also send back high-resolution images that could tell scientists about the suitability of those landing sites. NASA is planning to test launch the Prandtl M from a high-altitude balloon later this year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Militants linked to the Islamic State launched a coordinated series of attacks Wednesday on Egyptian military posts in North Sinai using car bombs and rocket-propelled grenades. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins me here in the studio. Victor.
Well, Susan, the Army says hours of fighting on Wednesday left 17 Egyptian officers and soldiers dead, along with 100 militants. Most of the fighting occurred near Sheikh Zuwait and Rafah, that's close to the Gaza Strip, and followed Monday's assassination in Cairo of Egypt's prosecutor general. Well, Wednesday's attack resulted in the highest number of casualties in Sinai since the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. The attack brought this response from John Kirby, a U.S. State Department spokesman.
We express our sincere condolences to the victims, their families, and the government and people of Egypt. These attacks come as Egypt is mourning the assassination of its public prosecutor, Hisham Barakat, on Monday. The perpetrators of these cowardly crimes must be brought to justice. The United States remains steadfast in its support of the Egyptian government's efforts to combat terrorism in Egypt.
Kirby says the Islamic State, known as Sinai Province, has claimed responsibility for Wednesday's attack. He says it's also known as Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, which the U.S. designated as a foreign terrorist organization last year. Meanwhile, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expressed his determination to defeat all forms of radical Islamism.
We see ISIS at the gates, across the border in the Golan, across the border in Egypt. We send our condolences to the government and people of Egypt for the fallen Egyptians slain by ISIS terror. We must stand up to all the forces of militant Islam, those led by Iran, those led by ISIS. We should not strengthen one or the other. We should weaken both of them. And as we do this, we'll continue our quest for a durable and secure peace with the Palestinians, mindful that we must not let militant Islam gain another foothold.
Wednesday's attack follows last month's death sentence handed down against ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, along with a number of senior officials of the outlaw Muslim Brotherhood. Separate attacks in North Sinai in April left nearly 30 dead, most of them security forces. Nabil Khoury, a Mideast studies professor at Northwestern University, told me Wednesday's attack clearly underscores a worsening security situation following the 2013 removal of Morsi from office.
There has been a security problem in Sinai for some time now, for several years, but part of it was based on disgruntled Bedouin communities in the Sinai and some smugglers of weapons that come from the Sudan up through the Sinai and into Gaza. But with the birth of ISIS and the spread of ISIS, and particularly since the military coup in Egypt and the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, there's been chaos. There's been a bit of vacuum in authority, even though the military is in charge. They've been too busy cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood to take proper security measures. And in addition, the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood is frustrating a lot of young Islamists who now feel that the Muslim Brotherhood's long history of nonviolent work and nonviolent protest is clearly not the way to go. And they are beginning to turn to more radical organizations. As a result, I think the Organization of the Islamic State has found a more receptive ground in Egypt than it otherwise would have. And it's recruited some young, frustrated people. And the combination, I think, of all these factors, we have a condition which we haven't seen in Egypt in a long time. I mean, the 73 war was a war between two countries. This is a question of a terrorist organization spreading and being able to attack the authorities from within.
Meanwhile, Australian National University Mideast analyst Amin Saikal told me President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi's hard line and exclusive strategy against militant Islamists appears not to be working, and it may be time to adopt a more inclusive approach and reach out to more moderate elements within the Muslim Brotherhood.
Thank you, Victor.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, remembering a European slaughter and an attempt to extradite FIFA officials. This month marks the 20th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre during the Bosnian War. In an interview with VOA, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, said there is broad global consensus about what happened at Srebrenica in July of 1995, when more than 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were systematically killed by Serbian forces because of their religious faith. After a meeting on the issue, VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir asked the ambassador about her personal experience in the Balkans and how it affects her work today.
One of the things I described in my remarks was being a reporter in Sarajevo and hearing that the Serbs were about to overrun the safe area of Srebrenica and imagining that that would be bad, but never being able to imagine that the Bosnian Serbs would set out to exterminate the Bosnian Muslim men and boys who were living in the safe area. It defied comprehension for me. I was a young reporter, maybe wasn't as world-weary as I should have been. Today in my job, I always believe if I see the facts and they're double-sourced and triple-sourced, and you hear reports of gas attacks against civilians or barrel bomb attacks or gulags in North Korea, and it's well-documented, You have to internalize that, and you have to bring that into the institutions of power, whether that's within the U.S. government or into the U.N. Security Council. You have to advocate relentlessly. You don't want to ever look back and think that you could have done something else. And so all of my commitments to human rights, to transitional justice, to preventing mass atrocity, to reconciliation in the wake of conflict, all of that, for me personally, grows out of the experience of having covered the war in Bosnia, but also having had the misfortune of bearing witness from afar, from Sarajevo, to the systematic slaughter of 8,000 Muslim men and boys.
And next week in the Security Council, we're expecting, hopefully, adoption of a British-drafted resolution commemorating the anniversary of Srebrenica. I understand the Russians have put forward a counter-proposal that doesn't mention Srebrenica. Where does the resolution stand, and do you expect it to be adopted?
I do expect it to be adopted, and I want to assure the people of Bosnia, above all, that there is broad global consensus about what happened in Srebrenica in July of 1995. There's not a lot of confusion about that. For political reasons, people may want to divert attention, and that's, you know, unfortunately what we deal with in the world. One of the things that's been reflected in our negotiations over the UN Security Council resolution is just how mainstream the facts of what happened in Srebrenica have become, the extent to which Bosnian historians, journalists, families who've told their horrible stories, they've won. I mean, they're not able to bring back their loved ones, but they have succeeded in defining the historical record, as has the Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia. So we expect the resolution to reflect the facts, and we won't accept anything less.
So in your remarks, you said those who deny that it was a genocide should feel embarrassed and humiliated. Who did you have in mind?
I've become a diplomat in my old age, so let's just say genocide deniers, they're not dealing with reality. I mean, they're trying to distort historical facts that have been amply documented over now 20 years. I mean, all you have to do is go and see the excavation of remains that will happen again this year. I've seen it happen on the 5-year anniversary, the 10-year anniversary, the 15-year anniversary. I've been back in Srebrenica and seen those families still grieving. Because they haven't been able to track down the remains of their loved ones. People can try to claim it wasn't what it was, but nobody's buying it, so they're just embarrassing themselves.
So finally, Ambassador, what's your message to the people of Bosnia and Herzegovina at this important time?
My message to the people of Bosnia is that we will never forget. We will pursue justice to the end of the earth, and I think we've proven that. There's not one indictee from the International Criminal Tribunal indicted for the crimes in Srebrenica left at large. There are still prosecutions, of course, going on within the Bosnian court system. We will support the domestic justice efforts. But basically, my main message is I'm sorry for you and I'm sorry for your families, and this must be an excruciating time.
Thank you for your time, Ambassador.
Thank you.
You're tuned to VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new is Google's self-driving test cars motoring around the roads of Mountain View, California. Google's Chris Urmson says if all goes well, these driverless cars will eventually save hundreds of thousands of lives.
If we can bring in technology that's always paying attention, that can see what's going on around it, that never gets distracted, this is a huge opportunity. This is one of these kind of 10x kind of opportunities to save lives and make the world a better place.
For now, the test cars will move at speeds no faster than 40 kilometers per hour, and a human test driver will be in the car for each ride, just in case. Along with saving lives, there are other major benefits of driverless cars. For instance, their ability to return home to park, waiting to be summoned by its owner when his or her workday is over.
When you start to think longer term about the impact on cities and the ability to reclaim space and to reduce congestion and free up parking, this is something where we can have a huge impact.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
The United States has asked Switzerland to extradite 7 officials with the World Football Organization, FIFA, in an ongoing corruption probe. The U.S. indictment issued in May charges 9 FIFA officials and 5 corporate executives with offenses that include racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. VOA's Jeffrey Young is right back here in the studio again with me, and welcome again, Jeffrey.
Susan, in order to be able to try to understand how it's possible for the United States to reach halfway around the world and grab people who may not even have ever set foot in the United States. I had a conversation with Stephen Schneebaum. He's a Washington attorney who specializes in international law, and he explains how the U.S. is able to do it and under what law these people are being brought to the United States.
Extradition is a creature of treaty, and there has been in place a treaty between the United States and the Swiss Federation since 1990. It's a standard treaty, very much like the bilateral treaties that the United States has with others of its allies, other developed countries. The process begins with a request that is made by the Justice Department, forwarded through the State Department, delivered to the Foreign Ministry in Bern, and then to the Justice Ministry under Swiss law. The allegation that the United States has to make is simply that there is reasonable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and that the individuals named in the request are, in fact, the individuals accused of those crimes. There's then a process under Swiss law, which I am not personally familiar with, but which I assume is similar to that in other developed countries, by which the Swiss authorities must satisfy themselves that the treaty prerequisites have been met. Once that happens, the individual is, or individuals are, transported to the appropriate state within the United States for proceedings under the indictment to go forward.
That was Stephen Schneebaum. He's a Washington attorney who specializes in international law.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
My pleasure.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Or if you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While there's been much encouraging news about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in recent months, new infections of the virus continue, and the United States remains committed to doing what it takes to stop them. U.S. Ebola treatment units and basic response infrastructure are in place, and thousands of U.S.-supported civilian responders are at work to fight the disease. It's killed more than 11,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and a handful of other countries, including our own. Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, but is still within a 90-day period on heightened security for recurrence of the disease. New cases continue to emerge elsewhere, with 8 recently identified in Sierra Leone and 12 in Guinea. Cases continue in areas bordering Guinea-Bissau, and efforts to ensure that country is better prepared for Ebola cases are underway. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is conducting trials on various candidate Ebola vaccines, including a controlled trial on the effectiveness of one vaccine in particular. NIH is also testing therapeutic drug candidates to treat those who have been infected, working to improve diagnosis of the disease, which has so far required sophisticated, labor-intensive DNA analysis, and trying to better understand how it causes the disease. In other words, the United States is supporting a wide range of research on prevention and treatment of Ebola. Meanwhile, a partnership between U.S. and Liberian researchers is studying approximately 7,500 people in that country, including 1,500 who survived Ebola within the last 2 years. Health investigators want to better understand Ebola's long-term health consequences and determine if survivors develop long-term immunity that will protect them from future infection. They also would like to better understand how the Ebola virus can persist in some organs of survivors long after they appear to have recovered, and the degree of risk that they can transmit the virus to others. While we have succeeded in controlling the exponential growth of the disease, getting to zero cases will require a sustained international response. The fight is far from over, and we remain committed to achieving an Ebola-free West Africa. The research U.S. and other scientists are carrying out now will improve the odds of preventing any future outbreak of Ebola from spreading, as the 2014 epidemic did.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.